The headlines this hour. Iran's parliament is set to hold a vote of confidence on the proposed cabinet lineup of President Ebrahim Raisi after 5 days of debates on the candidates' qualifications. A funeral is held for 32-year-old Palestinian Osama Khalid Deah, who succumbed to injuries sustained during an anti-Israel protest. And China once again urges the U.S. to stop politicizing the issue of COVID-19 origins, saying that it will provide access to its labs if Washington does the same. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's parliament is set to hold a vote of confidence on the proposed cabinet lineup of President Ebrahim Raisi after 5 days of debates on the candidates' qualifications. Raisi put up a final defense for his 19 picks for ministerial posts at parliament before the vote. During the past 5 days, lawmakers were reviewing the qualifications of the candidates, with the nominees taking the podium to present their plans. That followed by lawmakers taking the floor to argue for or against them. All of the nominees are predicted to win the confidence vote. However, if any of them fail, the president will have up to 3 months to name a replacement. Palestinians have held a mass funeral for a man who was fatally shot by Israeli forces in the besieged Gaza Strip. ...32-year-old Osama Khalid succumbed to his wounds after being shot during anti-Israel protests on Saturday. At least 40 more Palestinians were wounded by the regime's forces during the protests in the east of Gaza City. They were marking the 52nd anniversary of Israel's burning of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Osama Khalid's death comes one day after another Palestinian was shot dead by Israeli troops. Imad Hashash, a teenager, was killed when Israeli forces attacked a refugee camp near Nablus, north of the occupied West Bank. Tensions have remained high in the West Bank and Gaza in recent months, as Israel has escalated its crackdown against Palestinians. Our Gaza correspondent Ashraf Shannon says the silence of the international community on Israeli crimes is adding insult to injury of the Palestinian people.
Well, the apathy of the international community has been witnessed for decades. But this apathy and the silence of the international community increased rapidly following the normalization of ties between some Arab countries and the Persian Gulf region and the Israeli regime. Palestinians feel that they've been stabbed in the back by those Arabs, by the Arabs in the Persian Gulf region, and they believe that their normalization of ties and the opening of consulates and embassies, similar to that of the United Arab Emirates in Tel Aviv, only gave Israel the green light to further kill and maim Palestinians.
Israeli forces have demolished several more buildings belonging to Palestinian families in the occupied West Bank. Palestinian sources say the regime bulldozers backed by troops destroyed a house in the Silwan neighborhood in East Al-Quds. The demolition of the 90-square-meter home was carried out under the pretext of lacking construction license. Elsewhere in Walaja village near the city of Bethlehem, Israeli bulldozers tore down another house. A car workshop was also flattened near the city of Al-Khalil under similar pretexts. Israel demolishes homes on a regular basis in the occupied territories, citing different pretexts. Palestinians and rights groups say the Israeli demolition drive is aimed at grabbing more land for settlement expansions. Two Yemeni citizens have been killed after Saudi guards opened fire at a border with Yemen's Sada'a province. Yemeni media say the firing took place in the Munabi border district. Saudi forces target border villages with artillery and machine guns on an almost daily basis amid international silence. Riyadh, along with some of its Arab allies and backed by the U.S., launched a war in Yemen in March 2015. Tens of thousands of Yemenis, many of them women and children, have been killed ever since. Riyadh is still defying calls by the U.N. and rights groups to bring a halt to its cross-border aerial and ground attacks on the impoverished nation. Venezuela says it has handed over a report to the International Criminal Court on the damage caused by U.S. sanctions against the country. Caracas has accused Washington of crimes against humanity.
Yesterday, Venezuela submitted a report containing evidence of the damage caused by unilateral coercive measures against the Venezuelan people to the Office of the Prosecutor of the International Criminal Court.
Rodriguez said that there are reasonable grounds that the U.S. authorities have committed inhumane acts against the Venezuelan civilian population. She said crimes of murder, persecution, and extermination are some of those acts. The U.S. has stepped up its punitive measures against Venezuela in the past several years. It did so following Venezuela's 2018 presidential elections that the opposition claimed had been rigged. The U.S. also threw its backing behind opposition leader Juan Guaido, who declared himself president in January 2019. Venezuela has repeatedly urged the U.S. to stop interfering in its internal affairs. China and the U.S. have accused each other of bullying and coercion as the two remain at loggerheads over key issues, including security in the South China Sea. Vice President Kamala Harris has called for challenging China's excessive maritime claims. She made the comments during talks with Vietnamese officials in Hanoi. Harris is there as part of her Asian tour. Earlier in Singapore, she said Beijing's actions in the South China Sea amount to coercion and intimidation. Chinese state media said that Harris's comments aim to drive a wedge between Beijing and other countries in the region. The foreign ministry also reacted, accused the U.S. of hegemonic behavior. Beijing said Washington hides behind rhetoric of a rules-based global order to defend its practice. Political commentator George Samioli believes the U.S. is not by any means able to form a coalition in East Asia to stand against China.
The United States is having problems putting together an anti-China coalition in Southeast Asia along the lines of the famous Cold War anti-Russia coalition in Europe that actually survived the Cold War, the NATO, which is still in existence. The many countries in Southeast Asia and in Asia as a whole have very extensive commercial ties with China and don't wish to mess those up. So while countries such as Vietnam, Singapore, or the Philippines may have concerns about China, other countries are very dependent on commercial relations with China and will not want to join any kind of anti-China coalition from the United States. So this is a familiar pattern of U.S. leaders going to Asia and saying, hey, well, we've got to gather together an anti-China coalition, and the countries of Asia saying thanks but no thanks.
China has once again urged the U.S. to stop politicizing the issue of the origin of the novel coronavirus.
We once again urge the United States not to politicize the whole issue. I will say, scapegoating China cannot whitewash the U.S. If the United States persists in hyping up the lab leak theory, then they should set an example and invite the WHO to investigate the Fort Detrick and the University of North Carolina.
The official said Beijing will provide access to its labs if Washington does the same. Fu added that the U.S. has carried out more biomilitary activities than any other country in the world. His comments came after U.S. media reported that a classified report on the origins of COVID-19 had yielded no definite conclusions. President Joe Biden had commissioned the investigation 3 months ago, saying that the U.S. intelligence agencies were unsure whether the virus was the result of a lab leak or transmitted to humans via animals. In January, a team of World Health Organization experts determined it highly unlikely that the coronavirus was produced in a lab. The World Health Organization says COVID surges driven by the Delta variant are pushing health systems to the red line in the Western Pacific region.
But several countries in the Western Pacific are now experiencing surges, in part driven by the Delta variant. And our share of global cases and death is rising sharply. Surges are pushing health systems dangerously close to what we call the red line, where the number of critical cases exceeds ICU capacity and the hospitals can no longer provide the care that people need.
The WHO official said it is crucial to vaccinate priority groups such as health workers as soon as possible. He urged Western Pacific countries to respect public health measures to reduce transmission. According to the WHO, the region accounted for 10% of global COVID cases in the first 3 weeks of August. That was an increase from the original 2%. The organization says that over 6 million people across the Western Pacific have gotten COVID. Of them, more than 82,000 have died. The Philippines and Malaysia are the hardest hit. Representative of the World Health Organization to Tehran says that Iran is among countries which has already paid for vaccines from COVAX, but the delivery of the vaccines has been delayed for different reasons. Saman Khujuri reports.
Representative of the World Health Organization to the Islamic Republic of Iran, Dr. Jafar Hussain, has visited one of the main vaccination centers in capital Tehran to closely monitor the process of vaccination. In a country where the Delta variant of the coronavirus is killing almost 700 people on a daily basis. During his visit, he learned about different phases of the process, both before and after the vaccination. The WHO representative said that despite sanctions and economic problems, Iran is among countries which has already paid for vaccines from COVAX, but the delivery of the vaccines has been delayed for different reasons.
Iran is a country which has paid already for 16.8 million doses from COVAX, already paid with all the economic sanctions, everything it is facing. The problem is that because of the major outbreaks in other part of the world, like India, like Brazil and other, the vaccine availability globally reduced. What our director general is recommending to every country head of the state, that it is a whole of society, whole of government approach to control COVID. Not only government can do it, not only WHO can do it, not only other UN, not only private, everybody has to join hand.
The number of outpatients with COVID-19 has decreased by almost 2% this week. We anticipate that the number of hospitalizations will even come down next week.
Iran's death toll from COVID-19 has exceeded 100,000. The rapid rise in COVID-19 cases and deaths in the past weeks has prompted Iranian officials to make utmost efforts to import more vaccines and accelerate the vaccination pace.
According to official reports, almost 10% of the Iranian population have already received two jabs of the COVID-19 vaccines. Experts say the pace is too slow. Accordingly, the new Iranian government has vowed to take all necessary measures to accelerate the vaccination pace and manage the pandemic as soon as possible. Saman Khujuri, Tehran.
Australia has recorded its highest daily number of coronavirus cases since the start of the pandemic, as the Delta outbreak rages there. The infections at 919 were reported in Australia's most populated state, New South Wales. Officials have warned against growing pressure on hospitals in highly affected areas, mainly in the state's capital city, Sydney. They've also called for accelerating vaccinations to curb the surge. The Delta variant has increased infections and hospitalizations in Sydney, despite nearly 2 months of a lockdown there. The strain has also affected other major cities like Melbourne, prompting restrictions and lockdowns. Police have been deployed in some areas to help enforce the curbs, as some people are angry at the restrictions. Germany says it will try to help Afghans who worked with its soldiers and wish to leave the country even after the August 31st deadline for U.S. and its allies to pull out of Afghanistan. Chancellor Angela Merkel said Germany is working at all levels to find how it can protect those who helped it. Merkel said Berlin might try to help Afghans through the civilian operation of the airport in Kabul. The U.S. and its allies have so far evacuated over 70,000 people. Western countries are rushing to complete the airlift before the deadline under an agreement with the Taliban. The U.S. president says the evacuation is expected to complete before the deadline, but he has asked the Pentagon to come up with contingency plans if the deadline is not met. The Taliban have already rejected any extension to the deadline. Much is made of the so-called special relationship between the U.K. and the U.S. Both countries have many of the same interests, and both are strong proponents of promoting liberal democracy and free trade around the world, often by force. But this month's unilateral decision by the U.S. to withdraw its troops from Afghanistan has exposed the shakiness of the decades-long transatlantic relationship. Saeed Pourrezad takes a closer look.
A special relationship, a term coined after the Second World War by then-British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, to describe his country's close bilateral ties with former colony the U.S., from economic to cultural to military. Decades later, that supposed strong bond seems to exist in all but name.
It was never special. We already discussed the Suez Crisis, where the U.S., you know, basically told Britain to get out of the way, slapped it aside like a little child, a recalcitrant child. Tony Blair was the last British Prime Minister who really put a lot of political capital into this so-called special relationship. The price has been thousands of British soldiers killed, over 457 in Afghanistan alone.
Successive U.S. presidents have dealt serious blows to this transatlantic alliance, from Ronald Reagan, who ordered the invasion of Grenada, a Commonwealth country, when Margaret Thatcher was at number 10, the supposed acme of this special relationship, all the way to Trump and now Biden, who ordered the Afghanistan pullout without consulting the U.K.
It gives lie to the idea that there ever was a special relationship. It only existed in the deluded minds of British mandarins and British political elites, because they felt they still wanted to feel that Britain was a great power, and that they, even though they didn't have an empire, they still retained an empire state of mind. And that is now being blown right out of the water with the fall of Afghanistan.
In a sign of heightened tensions, the reaction from a man who got the UK involved in US-led wars in Afghanistan and later Iraq, and is a great believer in this special relationship. He has called Biden's decision imbecilic. With or without a strategy, it's happening. As U.S. troops evacuate defeated, so must their British peers, just as they went into the country in September 2001. The Taliban have ruled out any extension of the occupation.
If they are intent on continuing the occupation, so it will provoke a reaction.
The exit from Afghanistan is a chaotic one, and the fury at number 10 over being ignored and humiliated is palpable, offering a window into the state of the UK-US relations.
Theirs is a special relationship perennially skewed in Washington's favor, and where junior partner, the UK, plays the role of obedient sidekick. Saeed Puriza, London.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Of the approximately dozen wars the U.S. has fought since 1945, the United States has lost every real war it has fought. After millions of deaths of Americans and foreigners and trillions of dollars lost in places like Vietnam, Afghanistan, and the West Asia, is the U.S. any safer and secure because it fought these losing wars in far-off lands? No. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Miles Mogalescu, writer. This article is published under the heading, Despite Trillions Spent, U.S. Military Hasn't Won a Real War Since 1945. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. The United States emerged from its victory in the Second World War as the world's preeminent superpower. Its annual military budget, about three-quarters of $1 trillion a year, exceeds the aggregate of the next 10 countries in the world. Yet, despite America's apparent global military supremacy of the approximately dozen wars the U.S. has fought since 1945, depending on how you're counting, the United States has lost every real war it has fought. Its only victories have been minor military incursions to overthrow unfriendly governments in Grenada, population approximately 120,000 in Panama, population approximately 4.2 million. After millions of deaths of Americans and foreigners and trillions of dollars lost in places like Vietnam, Afghanistan, and West Asia, is the U.S. any safer and secure because it fought these losing wars in far-off lands? No, of course not. Have the American people benefited from these wars? No. Hundreds of thousands of troops have been killed or wounded, and trillions of dollars have been spent. So if the American people don't benefit from these endless losing wars, why do they keep fighting them? The short answer is that there are powerful forces in America that get rich from endless wars. The military-industrial complex and its political and economic servants and enablers. As Code Pink tweeted recently, President and former General Dwight D. Eisenhower warned in his 1961 farewell address to the nation, "We must never let the weight of this military-industrial complex endanger our liberties or democratic processes. Only an alert and acknowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals," unquote. Drive around the wealthy suburbs around the nation's capital and look at the multi-million dollar Mac mansions owned by corporate executives and lobbies, who are the real beneficiaries of America's forever wars. During the Afghanistan war, the stocks of the five largest defense contractors outperformed the S&P 500 by 58%. Fortunes end up in the pockets of corporate executives. They and their companies spend tens of millions of dollars lobbying Congress and contributing to Republican and Democratic politicians alike to buy their support for forever war and defense budgets totaling 60% of the federal government's discretionary spending. That's why, even as the Afghanistan war is ending, much of the corporate elite and the corporate media is getting up a new Cold War with China to justify continued overspending on the military. The main danger to U.S. security is not a military invasion by a heavily armed superpower enemy. Bigger national security threats today are climate change, cybersecurity, and global pandemics. These will not be addressed by spending more on the traditional military and fighting more losing forever wars. They require popular resistance to the military-industrial complex, the defeat of politicians under payroll, and the transformation of American priorities from preparing for and fighting useless wars to addressing the climate, economic inequality, and equal justice. As Warren Gunnels, staff director of the Senate Budget Committee, put it, the only thing that we accomplished by going into Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan was to put trillions of dollars into the military-industrial complex and destroy millions of lives, period, full stop. It's time to stop repeating the same mistakes over and over again.
It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd.
Islamic laws.
Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats the enchanted whisper.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And our guest speaker, as always, Sheikh Javid. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program again.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Well, the concept and the topic that we are going to delve into related to the Islamic laws issued by Ayatollah Sistani is mourning. And that is the mourning for Imam Hussein and Muharram. And this is actually a good platform for me and the whole crew here from the RIB English Radio to express our condolences to everybody who's listening to us, to our dear audiences. And inshallah, we hope that this program would come to good use. Let's take a listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Sistani and then we'll be back.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of five, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, and our guest and guest speaker, as always, Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, well, we are going to talk about some of the laws related to mourning and azadari. Let's shed some light, if you will, on the concept and notion of mourning and azadari for Imam Hussein. Would you?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There is no doubt, of course, that the tragedy of Karbala, when ascribed to the killers and to the murderers, is a criminal act. It is a terrible act.
Mm-hmm.
But when it is ascribed to Imam Hussein himself and his family, then it is a conscious confrontation on his part, and actually it is a courageous resistance for a sacred goal, a sacred end. And of course, the whole concept revolves around reviving Islam, resuscitating Islam, which was endangered badly by Yazid and his criminal friends and thugs who were with him, of course. As you know, from the viewpoint of history, if we discuss this issue, we know that the entire nation of Islam had failed to stand up to Yazid, and they had to succumb or surrender themselves to Yazid's will. Whatever he wanted, the people had to follow him.
Yes.
And obviously, in this particular situation, Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam made up his mind to stand up against Yazid in his tyrannical regime. And of course, otherwise it would be the end of Islam. Islam had been endangered badly by Yazid. So Imam Hussein took it upon himself, the responsibility of the whole nation. And of course, the greatest tragedy was that one who stood up for the noblest of causes, the defense of Islam, was cut down in so cruel and remorseless way. He was, of course, on the day of Ashura, he was martyred, his family was captivated, taken captives, and of course, his children were also martyred along with him.
And also tortured on the way.
They were tortured. Of course, the story is horrendous. It is inexplicable.
Yes.
Because it's we find no words to explain the tragedy.
Express the true felt heartfelt feelings.
Of course.
Yes.
And of course, the story continued. It did not stop there. On the day of Ashura, it continued from that day onward until Zainab, you see, went to Syria, to Damascus, and then came back to Medina. And all the way from Karbala to Syria, and from Syria to, it was a journey of pain and sorrow and grief. Yes. And of course, so it is actually for this reason that the sacrifice of Imam Hussein is actually commemorated every day. And we as Shia Muslims have to be proud of having such a school of resistance, of course. We must be honored, we must be proud of being the follower of such a great leader. And we must be proud of following such examples, such noble examples, such as Imam Hussein and his brother Abul Fazl Abbas and his children Ali Akbar and Ali Asghar. Okay. So the concept of azadari, or the concept of mourning for Imam Hussein, I should say in brief, it's not about weeping, crying, and beating your chest, and of course taking into the streets and chanting, okay, poems. So we must understand, we must come to terms with the concept of Ashura. We must know that the goal of Ashura, for which Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam stood up,
yes,
is not beating ourselves or shedding tears,
yes,
and weeping. We must understand the philosophy, the concept of Ashura. And of course, Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam, just in a letter he wrote to his own brother, he highlighted some of the main goals. He said,
Let me stop you there to take a short break,
okay,
and we'll be back. Stay tuned to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We'll be back shortly.
I work in the night with millions of stars. Your eyes pull me to you. Who are you? I walk in the day with millions of angels. I see you in all these faces. Who are you? One step I fade away, the next step I'm born again. You're flowing in my veins. Who are you? Wherever I get tired, you call me from far and near. Whenever I get thirsty, you start to melt and say to me,
back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the concept and philosophy of azadari and mourning, and you were stating, Sheikh Javid, about the letter in which some of the goals have,
yes,
been expressed.
Of course, in a letter to his brother Muhammad Hanafi, I think of course Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam mentioned and stated clearly some of the goals. He said that he's not a rebel, first of all,
mm-hmm,
and he's not rising up against Yazid for fame, to gain reputation. Of course, he was standing up against Yazid for justice in order to revive Islam. And of course, justice was the main goal for which Imam Hussein, of course, stood up.
Mm-hmm.
And so he went to Makkah. He left Medina for Makkah. And of course, he did not complete his pilgrimage,
mm-hmm,
of the house of God. He left Makkah before completing the Hajj rituals. And he went to Karbala. Of course, his intention was to go to Kufa, because a lot of people who were supposedly his supporters, of course, he went to Kufa because he was promised allegiance,
mm-hmm,
by those people in Kufa.
Yes,
but unfortunately, on his
they
way
broke
to
the
Kufa,
promise.
Yeah. Unfortunately, those people broke their promises, and also he was stopped before reaching, and of course before reaching Kufa,
mm-hmm,
he was stopped at a point where it was called, for example, Karbala, or of course the older name I suppose was Nainawa, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Sheikh Javid, we all know that being dressed in black is kind of reprehensible,
yeah,
usually,
of course,
in Islam, according,
yes,
to the laws, right? But is it reprehensible or makruh to wear black during Muharram and Safar?
Of course not, because according to all religious authorities, wearing black is even recommended,
mm-hmm,
because it reminds us of the tragedy of Karbala. And it is not only reprehensible, but even it is recommended because of the fact that it reminds us of the tragedy of Karbala. And in order for us to show that we sympathize with the family of the Prophet,
mm-hmm,
and the family of Imam Hussein alayhi wasallam and his family members, of course,
mm-hmm,
we show black. And we sympathize, we wear black and we sympathize with them. there's no objection in wearing black.
Mm-hmm, I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Once again, I use this opportunity to express our heartfelt condolences to our dear audiences, and may God accept all of our mourning and azadari for Imam Hussein and their pure household. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave, mankind's heart it reawaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred bridge. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sand, met foreigners of new land.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Thanks to the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979, the Palestinian issue was saved from being completely forgotten. Dear listeners, please stay with us for an article in this regard written by the staff of Kayhan International. This article is published under the heading, Only Islamic Unity Will Salvage Al-Aqsa Sanctity. Here's more on this issue.
Hello.
What makes Palestinian Muslims in Beit al-Muqaddas and the Muslim world being helpless watchers or, at the most, harmlessly angry protesters at the frequent violation of the sanctity of Islam's former Qibla or prayer direction, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, by Zionist marauders supported by Israeli regime occupation forces? The disunity of the Islamic Ummah, of course, in view of the treason of several regimes in power in Muslim lands, not as representatives of the people they rule, but as clients of the U.S. regime. Recently, the Palestinian Islamic Council expressed alarm that the Zionist regime's stepping up of excavations and drilling underneath the sacred precinct of Al-Aqsa is weakening the foundations and may result in the collapse of the whole structure. Its statement indicated disunity at home amongst the Palestinians when it said engagement in real estate deals with Israelis is a great betrayal of religion, the homeland, and morals. Whoever colludes with this crime is a conspirator against the land, the cause, and the people, and has sold himself to the devil. It shows the depth of despair amongst the Muslims 52 years after the arson attack by Australian Zionist terrorist Dennis Michael Rohan on Al-Aqsa on August 21st. That made Muslim countries meet in Morocco to form the Organization of the Islamic Cooperation, OIC, which unfortunately has done nothing concrete for Beit al-Muqaddas. The fire destroyed nearly a third of the mosque, including the 1,000-year-old priceless wood and ivory pulpit, as the Israelis cut off water from the area and prevented fire engines from reaching the site to extinguish the fire. Though the Muslim countries succeeded in pressuring the UN on September 15, 1969, to adopt Resolution 271 to denounce such a violation, no further progress was made to prevent the Zionist regime from its frequent violation of the sanctity of Al-Aqsa and the current intrusion into this sacred Islamic site by gangs of illegal Zionist settlers, despite the fact that entry of non-Muslims or their acts of worship are strictly banned. The reason is obvious. It is the disunity of the Ummah. If Morocco and Jordan, which before the Israeli occupation of Beit al-Muqaddas in 1967 was in charge of governing this Islamic city and its holy sites, were in secret contacts with the illegal Zionist entity, the traitor Anwar Sadat of Egypt openly betrayed the Palestinian cause by signing the scandalous Camp David Accord. Thanks to the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979, however, the Palestinian issue was saved from being completely forgotten. The historic move by the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, in designating the last Friday of the fasting month of Ramadan as the World Poets Day, not only mobilized Muslim masses all over the world for renewing allegiance every year to the cherished goal of liberating Al-Aqsa in Palestine, but made Iran the fulcrum of the resistance front for practical efforts to achieve this objective. Today, despite the Israeli regime atrocities, all eyes are glued to the Islamic resistance front, which is becoming stronger day by day, and from Gaza has now penetrated the interior of the usurped land of Palestine for delivering the coup de grace. It means that they will surely dawn on 11th free of the filth of Israel, no matter if certain Persian Gulf Arab regimes indulge in treason and treachery by dallying publicly with the Zionist entity. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. We've spoken a lot about the ziyarah and the visitation of Imam al-Hussein alayhi wasalam, and especially the merits of the particular place of the grave of Imam al-Hussein, the soil that surrounds that place, the soil that surrounds the city, the benefit and the blessings of one who visits, in terms of that person will be prayed for by the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, by the angels, by the jinn, by the fish, by the creation, by everything. But does this mean that, you know, those who cannot go for the ziyarah are deprived of this? The Imams alayhim as-salam themselves have given advice on how to perform the ziyarah from a distance. And who knows, maybe, you know, it is counted, you know, as a better ziyarah and a more influential ziyarah in our lives than that ziyarah that we go close to the grave of Imam Hussein alayhi wasalam. Why? Because it is done with intention, it is done with purity, it is done with sincerity. While we are there, we might be, you know, may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala protect us from this, but because we are there, we might have, you know, some arrogance in our heart, you know, I am here, and that person is not here. Or we might have some, you know, riyah in our hearts, that, oh, look, I'm here, I should perform it in this way, and people look at me, that I'm doing it in these haram of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and so on and so forth. So we have these type of possibilities. So here in this tradition from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he tells one of his companions that, you know, regarding the ziyarah and the visitation of Imam Hussein alayhi salam from a distance, and it should also be performed from a distance. It should not just be left that a person who, no, I have to go to the grave, and I, no, create a connection with the Imam. A connection of souls does not need distance, my dear brothers and sisters. Create a connection with the Imam. So Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is reported to have said that if any of you lives far from us, that is any of the Imams alayhi salam, and there is a great distance between you and us, and this is what the Imam recommends, you should ascend to the highest place of your home, wherever that may be. There are other traditions that we will mention, that if this is not, there are other traditions that say a person should go somewhere else. Inshallah, we will mention those traditions as well. Highest place of your house, establish two units of prayer, point towards our graves, and say salam to us. All you have to say is a simple salam. Assalamu alaykum Ya Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, wa assalamu alayk, you know, Ya Abu al-Hassan, Ya Ali ibn Musa Rida, or any of the Imams, for verily it will reach us. Allah. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to give us the ability to create this connection with the Imams alayhi wa sallam, that even from afar, where most of us are, we don't forget the Imams, and we create this connection with our Imams. Inshallah, until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your